I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Today we discuss death cafes. Later in the program, we drop in on a rehearsal of Seasons, a hospice choir in Brewster. First, when was the last time you had a discussion about death and dying? Unless a friend or family member recently passed away, chances are the topic has not come up. Despite the fact that death is inevitable for everyone, it becomes almost invisible in our society and a taboo topic. Death cafes are springing up across the globe in an effort to stimulate dialogue about death and dying. And joining us to talk about the Falmouth Death Cafe is Reverend Nell Fields of the Wacoit Congregational Church. Good morning.
Good morning.
Heather Massey, home funeral educator and representative for the Funeral Consumers Alliance of Eastern Massachusetts. Good morning, Heather.
Good morning, Amy.
And Reverend Jonathan Drury of the First Congregational Church of Falmouth. Good morning.
Good morning, Mindy.
All right, so let's start with what is a death cafe? I mean, right, you hear death cafe. It's like, what? What is that?
Heather, you want to take that?
Sure. Okay. The Death Cafe is not a place. It is not a freestanding cafe, but it is instead a gathering of people in a for everybody in the community to participate in a conversation around death, any issues around death, dying, and bereavement in a safe and comfortable environment with facilitated conversation.
And one of the things, though, it is not religious and it's not a bereavement like support group kind of
right.
thing, right?
And it's not really a cafe either. All the coffee and all the cake and the cookies are free.
Mm-hmm. So this name, Death Cafe, I would imagine some people go, oh, you know, did you get some flack about the name Death Cafe?
Oh my gosh, yes. And Jonathan has a great story about that.
All right, Jonathan.
Well, when I was first approached by Nell and Heather to see if we would like to host the Death Cafe at the First Congregational Church, I was very open to the idea, but when I presented the possibility to my congregation, there were a number of folks who felt that the name was prohibitive, that they just couldn't get past that. And they explained to me that they would never be able to attend something that was called the Death Cafe. So we had one or two of our cafes, and we continue to receive this feedback from folks. So I decided to propose to the group that we consider changing the name. Ultimately, that decision would have to be made by the group. So at the beginning of one of our meetings, I just brought the question forward, and I had come up with a great alternative name, or at least I thought it was great. there's a line in Hamlet where Hamlet reflects on his dying, and he says, when we shed this mortal coil, what dreams may come? And so I thought we could call it the What Dreams May Come Cafe or This Mortal Coil Cafe, something a little bit more benign than Death Cafe. So I proposed this to the group, and then we continued to have our meeting, and we broke into small groups and had a conversation. At the very end, we regathered and decided we would take a vote, and it was unanimous that we should keep it the Death Cafe. And there were a number of people in attendance who had originally come to me regarding the name. And I, for the life of me, don't know what changed over the course of that hour. Though I think part of it is that over the course of the hour, people became more comfortable with the whole concept of death.
Right.
And they realized that this is exactly what it claims to be. It's a place where we talk about death.
And of course, this is not, you didn't make this up, Heather, right? There are many, so tell us about death cafes. There's a whole lot of them all over the globe.
Exactly. This is like a social franchise or chapter or affiliate of the International Death Cafe Movement. And Death Cafe was originated in Switzerland and by a gentleman by the name of Bernard Kreatz. And he was a sociologist and just did it as an experiment. And then Jonathan Underwood in England took it on, and he and his mother actually started the Death Cafe website and produced a manual for how to go about doing that. And that was in 2011. And in 2012, Lizzie Miles from Columbus, Ohio, was the first person in the United States to bring it on, to bring it over here.
So how did the Falmouth Death Cafe get started? Now, did you hear about it? I mean, how did that happen?
Well, first of all, I started reading about it, maybe in the New York Times and USA Today. And at the same time, being a minister, you deal with death.
Mm-hmm.
And what I was finding is that as some of the elders were in hospice care, their children, who perhaps either lived in town or were coming from other parts of the United States, were trying to plan a funeral. They were trying to put a trust together. They were trying to, at the very last minute, and I was thinking, oh my gosh, you can't do this 2 or 3 days before someone dies. And then I said, you know, if these folks are having issues, there have to be other people who are having issues. So I first actually talked to Jonathan, say, Jonathan, are you sort of dealing with this? And he said, yes. And as the universe has it, while Jonathan and I were talking about it, I met Heather and she was interested in it. And I said, let's do a Death Cafe. And I was scared.
Yeah.
I didn't like the name. Mm-hmm. I thought people would think we were odd. I had no idea what the first meeting would be like, but my fears were subsided. The first meeting came off great, and as Jonathan pointed out, we embraced that name, Death Cafe. Mm-hmm. And now, we're about 5 months into it, it is the most liveliest, fun bunch of people, great conversation. If you walked in, you think that we were just having some sort of party and drinking tea and eating cake. You would have no idea what we were talking about.
All right, so somebody describe a typical session.
Well, Jonathan, you want to do that?
Sure. Well, we gather at 6:30 in the evening, and the last three sessions we've begun with someone who's been asked to provide some type of a conversation or some resources around one particular subject. This is a little bit different than the original model for the Death Cafe. The Death Cafe itself, actually, that term applies to the conversation that occurs following our guest speaker. So the Death Cafe doesn't actually begin until around 7 o'clock or 7:15. Those first 45 minutes are optional, but what we discovered was that there were a lot of folks who really had just questions about information. There's just a lack of knowledge out there about death and end-of-life considerations. So we compiled a list of themes and topics that we've used to help organize the conversation prior to the Death Cafe. After the speaker has finished, we then divide ourselves into small groups, and we have a series of questions, sometimes related to the conversation that occurs before, but not always. And we then just have these conversations in small group that the conversations themselves are facilitated. We have certain rules or guidelines that we try to follow. We want to make sure that everyone has an opportunity to be listened to and to have a chance to speak. We don't put any pressure on people. If there's a theme or a topic or a question that's being discussed and people don't feel comfortable discussing it, that's absolutely fine. But we do try to have a little bit of a structure to that portion of the evening. And then after we've had about half an hour to 45 minutes of conversation, we regather and kind of compare notes and see if there was any profound learnings that mm-hmm. should be shared with the whole group. And then we prepare ourselves for the next month's meeting.
So what are some of the different topics you've covered?
Oh, gosh. Well, we've talked about end-of-life wishes or end-of-life decisions. Some questions have included, you know, what songs do you want to have played if you're in the if you are dying or at your funeral? We've talked about hospice care. We've talked about what's your idea of a good death. Heather, can you think of some other?
Green burial, family-directed after-death care, coffins and urns is ones that are going to come up. We did funeral costs. We're going to do one on advanced directives in the near future. Pain control at the end of life. Writing your own obituaries. We're going to have
yes.
one session on that as well.
And
pet deaths as well.
I was going to say pet
right.
death. One of the things that we do, we ask people, what would you like to hear? What would you like to have discussed? And I'll tell you something. Some of them are very practical questions. For an example, what do you do? What's the first thing you do if somebody dies in your house?
Hmm.
What do you do?
Call 911. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, it really depends on yeah. what is it, unattended death? Does this, if it is, if the person's already in hospice
right.
in your home, you want to call hospice. But it's really kind of a real practical, how do we do things? And one of the things why I think it's important to talk about these things, if you are busy at the very last moment when someone is dying, putting together all these plans, trying to gather all the relatives, trying to figure out what are you going to do with the funeral and what am I going to do with some sort of memorial service, I think it sometimes delays and complicates grief.
Yeah, it does.
Really good point. I mentioned before we went on the air, my mom died suddenly. My dad died of cancer. So my mom's funeral is a total blur. It was one of those, oh my gosh, we got to get all this. Same thing. Where my dad, we had time to have conversations that we didn't have to have, that we didn't get to have with my mother. And it is a completely different experience. And you're right. The grieving process is much different, I think, when you're prepared for it and you've, you know, answered questions and you've had these conversations. So you answered my next question of why is it important for people to discuss death. Anybody else want to add in on that?
Well, we live in a death denying culture, and it's not something that we don't see death. We don't experience it as we used to. We used to, our loved ones used to die at home, and we would care for their bodies at home after death. And now many people die in nursing homes or hospitals, and the body is taken away soon after. And so we don't have that. It's not part of our everyday lives. And that's part of the intention behind the Death Cafe movement, is to normalize death and to allow for people to talk about that which we do not experience generally.
Now, and as you mentioned, this, it wasn't always such a taboo subject for, you know, not that long ago, really. You know, several generations ago, it was common for people to die at home and for family members to bury their own dead. So why did this all change?
I think it's because of our urbanization of culture. People started moving off the farms. They started collecting in cities or in the suburbs. And, you know, you just couldn't bury somebody in the backyard anymore. And so an industry grew on helping families take care of their death ones. Mm-hmm. And that made a lot of sense. I think sort of culturally and philosophically, things probably changed way back during the Age of the Enlightenment, when there was sort of this split between body and mind and soul. Mm-hmm. And so the soul was the purview of the church or the faith communities, and the mind and body was sort of left in science. And so it's easy to sort of take care of that scientific part.
Right. Anybody else have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do. I think part of the change is a cultural one. And it may be that the Western world has grown increasingly affluent, and so we have more resources available to us. But it appears to me that we live in a world today where we are so fearful of growing old and the inevitability of dying, that we try hard to remove the aged from our life. And we have lots of ways to do that. We have a lot of wonderful elder care facilities. But the result is that oftentimes we aren't there as present as we once were to experience the end of life stage with our loved ones. And so even though we're aware that this is going to happen, every one of us will pass away, we're sometimes surprised when it happens.
We are talking about death cafes. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. When was the last time you had a discussion about death and what precipitated that conversation? Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about death cafes and Falmouth's Death Cafe with Reverend Nell Fields of the Wacoit Congregational Church, Reverend Jonathan Drury of the First Congregational Church of Falmouth, and Heather Massey, home funeral educator and representative for the Funeral Consumers Alliance of Eastern Massachusetts. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number if you'd like to join the conversation. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Are you reticent to talk about death? If so, tell us why. So do you think that having discussions about death and dying helps people with the grieving process?
I do. I think that the more that we know about death and really understand something that is obvious, that it's inevitable, that when we start preparing for a good death, we do kind of like a mini kind of grieving process, is that we know what's going to happen to a person. And if we need to say something to that person, if we need to get forgiveness for that person, or if we need to forgive that person, it gives us time to prepare emotionally for that. And so the grieving process, because let's face it, death is sad.
Oh, for sure.
Death is sad. The grieving process is healthier.
I think talking about death also acknowledges and honors the grieving process. You know, in our culture, we don't see grief so much anymore. We do not wear black clothing. There is no way to distinguish whether or not somebody is grieving and why they can't do math or carry on a conversation or have to leave the grocery cart in the grocery store because they are just overcome with grief.
Right. That's a good
we don't
point,
have that outward acknowledgement of that somebody is in a very vulnerable state. Talking about it helps both them and the rest of us as well. Also, I was noted not too long ago that, you know, we have names for people who have lost their spouses, widows and widowers, but we don't, and also for children, they are orphans, but we don't have a name, for instance, for parents who have lost a child. And we just don't have enough even language around it because we don't talk about it enough.
So talking about death, of course, is difficult for many reasons, one of those being uncertainty about the afterlife. And many of our beliefs about the afterlife are closely linked with our religious beliefs. So can this make the conversation about death difficult and uncomfortable if people have different views about afterlife?
You know, that's a good question. And I can one of the things I want to say about the Death Cafe is that there's no religious or spiritual agenda whatsoever, even though we're holding it in a church. I have to say, for the past five sessions, the idea of spirituality, what happens in the afterlife, has never come up.
Is that right?
Yes. Huh. I don't know about with you two. Has it come up with you?
It has come up in my group. But it varies. But I think that people are very respectful. In any given group, it's random which group you end up being assigned to. We have such a large turnout that we generally break up into smaller groups of five to seven or so. Something that's manageable so everybody has an opportunity to speak. And in our groups, a couple of times, it has come up. And it was very clear that not everybody in the group had the same idea at all about the afterlife, or even if there is one.
Right.
And yet that there was that, there's that opportunity to express where you feel from and listen to one another.
Mm. I think, too, that there's an important distinction to be made between our spiritual view of the afterlife versus our religious view of the afterlife. People feel okay. They feel somewhat more comfortable talking about their own spiritual beliefs without it being in the context of religious dogma. And personally, I find that that is one of the great values of the Death Cafe. From an entirely selfish perspective, I love to hear people's stories of those moments where they really feel like they are it's almost a transcendent moment where they're brushing up against the immortal or the divine. And when I hear those stories, I come away feeling very much inspired.
You mentioned, Heather, that you have such a large group. So who's showing up? I mean, you have a little bit of everybody. I mean, are they well attended?
They are well attended. When we first started, and we didn't tell anybody about this because we were so freaked out about the name, we'd have about two dozen people. And then when we started advertising it, on our last group, what did we have? 40, 45, 48 people. And people from all walks of life. They tend to be kind of baby boomers, but we've had some younger people and we've had some elderly people.
Interesting.
It's really a nice cross-section of the community. It's been interesting. And we have many repeat folks. Some people have been there. It's actually seven we're going on
seven?
Now.
Seven? Oh,
yes,
I keep saying five.
October. Since October of 13.
Is there anybody else on the Cape that you know of doing this or the islands?
There are other groups around. Not everybody is using this name, but there have been other groups of people that are gathering casually.
I think it's really part of a cultural shift where people are starting to talk about death. And you'll find some of the hospice companies holding groups. Now, the hospice groups don't want to have a organization called Death Cafe for obvious reasons, but they are encouraging people to talk about this. One of the analogies I like using is that years ago, we never talked about cancer.
Right.
It was the big C.
Right.
And now, in terms of cancer awareness, we've got our pink ribbons, we've got our pink mugs, and everybody is talking about it. And what a huge, healthy shift that has been for everybody because we're so aware of it.
You know, you make a really good point just about the knowing, and going back to hospice for a second, and that's a whole other program, mm-hmm. but I think those hospice workers are just amazing people. And we did have hospice when my father died, and it was so helpful to know what the signs are. Here are the signs, you know, when death is finally here, mm-hmm. and what he's going through, what you're going through. I mean, that whole education process was so helpful through that time.
Yeah. Well, and so let me ask you this. How did that change your view on death?
I don't know if it changed my view on death. I like I said, it was a different experience than, you know, the shock of a sudden death versus a death you know is coming. Like you said, it's sad. It's difficult no matter which road you go down. But it did make it, I think, easier in some ways to just know what was happening. Another thing that makes talking about difficult is the fact that you have no idea when it's going to happen most of the time. You could die today, not for decades. It's kind of unsettling, and mm-hmm. people don't like to think about, well, I'm going to die someday.
Right, right.
So that's another. Do you have people talk about that when they come to the Death Cafe?
Absolutely. And the fact that everybody that they know and love is going to die as well.
Right. And it's kind of a depressing thought.
Well, and yet it does enhances life to talk about it. You end up thinking, well, what am I going to do with this life since I'm here?
Right.
And maybe I'm a middle-aged person. And how much more stuff do I need if I'm only going to be on the planet for another 20 years, et cetera?
I have found for myself that I've always embraced life, but from the experiences of leading a number of people with funerals and also the Death Cafe, I find that I even embrace life more, mm-hmm. that I realize how short life is. And don't wait till I die to have a celebration. I want a party now. You know, let's celebrate life now because it is inevitable. We all know how the story ends. We just don't know when.
Right. Jonathan, you mentioned how inspired you are by some of the stories. And I think that plays off of what Heather and Elle are saying about these conversations. Maybe have you reflect a little bit on the life you're living now, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I don't want to give away too much information because I think we've made a real commitment to make sure that these meetings are intended to be confidential and we don't share, certainly wouldn't share people's names. But I've had the opportunity through the Death Cafe to speak to some folks who have had some near-death experiences. And boy, there is nothing more compelling than to speak to someone who says, I know what's coming because I've experienced it. And this, you know, this is changed the way I view my life today, and you can use this information any way you want. When I hear those stories, I come away feeling, like I said, very much inspired and feeling like, you know, this isn't it. There's more waiting. We may not be able to put our finger on exactly what it is that's waiting, but just knowing that there's more to come.
866-999-4626 is our toll-free number if you'd like to join our conversation. We're talking about death cafes, 866-999-4626, or death conversations. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Do you think, you mentioned cancer, how we never used to talk about it,
right.
And now everybody has conversations. Do you see the culture changing in how we talk about and deal with death?
I do. I think that we really want to be more authentic about things. So even though we want to prolong our lives and maybe get facelifts and things like that, I think there's a move for embracing, you know, being authentic. And talking about death is, you know, just another part of life.
So, Heather, you are an at-home funeral educator. So explain what an at-home funeral is.
That is where it's family-led and generally home-based, and that is where the families are acting as their own funeral director. So they can take responsibility for caring for the body after death, for carrying out after-death rituals, and even if they want to do transportation to final disposition and making arrangements for that. Some families choose to do a hybrid situation where they do some of that themselves. They just want more time with their loved one at home in order to grieve and say goodbye, and then hire a funeral home to do some of the other aspects like the paperwork and transportation.
I bet there's a lot of people who don't know you can do that because there's so many rules and regulations, right, around, you know, what happens to a body when somebody dies. But so I bet there's a lot of people who don't even realize you can do that.
Exactly. That's usually the first question that I get. Is that legal? And yeah. It actually has always been legal in Massachusetts, and it's legal in all states to care for your own dead. However, in 9 states, there are some restrictions in terms of the paperwork or our transportation for final disposition. But in Massachusetts, you always have been able to care for your dead completely if you want to after death.
What, from your experience, what is that experience like when people do have that time, you know, to have their loved one with them longer? Does it change the grieving process? Is it helpful?
I think it's extremely helpful, and that's the reason why many people choose to do it, because the body is not whisked away right away, and they have an opportunity to recreate rituals that might have come from their heritage, their spiritual traditions. A lot of people don't even realize how they'll take advantage of that time until they reach it. And it's a time for families to have privacy in getting used to the loss of their loved one, and for letting go and doing it in their way and being the last ones to care for their loved ones.
Bob is giving us a call from Brewster. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Mindy. How are you?
I'm good.
I congratulate you for having this topic on the show. I think it's incredibly important. I just wanted to bring up something called the Conversation Project. I don't know if...
They're all nodding their heads, yeah.
But I found it was the best way for me to start the conversation with my family was to go online to theconversationproject.org, and they give you a starter kit to tell you and show you how to begin the conversation with your own family about the end of your life. It started by Ellen Goodwin, who is a Boston Globe reporter, who's developed this nationwide organization to help people tell the story and speak about the end of their own lives.
And it's Bob Marterstock, right?
Yeah,
Bob. Right. I was thinking of you when we did this. Bob was a financial planner, and Bob has actually been on the program where we've talked about. This is one of the other programs where we talk about death and preparing and planning. Bob, I'm glad you called in. You all know about this project he's talking about.
Yes. We do,
absolutely.
And we're planning on implementing some of that here in Falmouth as well. What I wanted to do is just distinguish the difference between a death cafe and the Conversation Project, which we completely support. We think it's wonderful that there is conversation about death in all different venues. The Conversation Project is a way of giving you some tools to talk to your family. And we talk some about that in the Death Cafe, but the Death Cafe is more like having the conversation within your community about all aspects of death, dying, and bereavement.
And what we plan to do is, after the Death Cafe, give people a list of questions that they can then go home and share with their spouse or share with their family so they can continue that conversation within their own homes.
Yeah, Bob, thanks for calling in.
Thanks, Mindy.
Sure.
Thanks so much.
866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we'll put links up to your Death Cafe as well as the Conversation Project on our website, capeandislands.org. You're talking here about the Death Cafe and the importance of coming together as a community to share these stories and experiences, rather than kind of just individually. So talk about the significance of this being a community thing rather than just an individual thing.
Well, I think it's important that we hear each other's stories and that we engage with each other. I think also on some level, bringing it out of the family does get the public to talk about it a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And so it's one thing to have, and it's important to have that conversation with your family. I think it's equally important to have that conversation with your neighbors and with each other.
Yeah. You know, I think in some ways our memorials, our funerals that we organize for people when they've passed away are probably as close as we come to a community's response to death and dying. So there is a real communal quality to our relationship with dying. The fact that we can have these conversations amongst ourselves as a community, I think it speaks volumes about who we are in terms of the community itself. I think a lot of folks come to the Death Cafe because they leave feeling connected with other people. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes people come really not knowing anyone. There's some apprehension there. What is this and what am I doing here? By the end of that hour, they have a much better sense of the benefit of the program. But also, I think they come away really feeling like they have engaged with their neighbors in a remarkable way.
And Jonathan, I totally agree with you. One of the things I love about the Death Cafe is that I am sitting with 5, 6, 7 people, many I do not know, and we're sharing our stories. And there is that connection and that connectedness that happens. And that's so life-affirming.
I'm also wondering, too, I mean, obviously there are many people who are afraid of the, you know, that whole fear of dying, and having these conversations maybe eases that fear somewhat.
Absolutely. Oh. Absolutely.
So we said earlier that the deaf cafes are springing up around the globe, especially in North America. Deathcafe.com has a listing of them. But if someone's interested in starting their own death cafe, what advice do you give them?
Well, the first thing I would do is, if they want to have the death cafe experience, is to go to that website, deathcafe.com, read through how it's done. I would definitely get the support of 2 or 3 other people within a community. And that's it. Just start talking.
You can download a manual to help you start. There are a lot of suggestions. And what's nice is there is a facilitators forum on the deathcafe.com. So you can see what other experiences people have had around the globe and ways that they've chosen to bring it to their communities.
And I think from based on our experiences, because we're keeping track of the questions we've had, and hopefully we'll have a chance fairly soon to sort of sit down and sort of codify the things that we've done, what's gone well, what hasn't. And if people want to contact us for our experiences, we'd be very happy to share that.
What about listeners who might be sort of on the fence about attending a death cafe? What would you say to them?
Jump.
Just try it.
Yeah.
It's always safe. It's a safe and comfortable place. There's great cake and tea and coffee.
Oh, that's right. I was supposed to talk about the cake.
Exactly. That there's no intention to lead anybody. That's one of the principles of a death cafe, that we're not leading anybody in any direction to any one conclusion. It is not a religious or spiritually oriented conversation, and that is always offered on a not-for-profit basis.
Mm-hmm. Maybe you can talk, Heather or Nell or Jonathan, about the end-of-life planning. We do have some people who are very good. You know, they make their wishes known, others who do not. But this whole, the idea of what you want to happen should be part of that conversation. So along with, you know, the will, who's getting what, or, you know, the living wills, who's going to make these decisions, this whole conversation about, you were saying earlier, Nell, the music, who would I like to mm-hmm. speak at mm-hmm. my funeral, or what kind of a funeral do I want? Those are all really important things to talk about.
How would you like to be remembered?
Exactly. Well, they are important things to talk about, and I think those are part of a very healthy conversation that parents can have with their children, or spouses can have with each other, because as you never know when it is going to happen or how it's going to happen. And I think that it, yes, it helps people with sort of the planning piece, but for a person who's dying, I think it's a more dignified death for them, knowing that this is the way I want things to happen, and knowing that it's going to happen that way.
Exactly. Exactly.
My experience, too, in preparing for a memorial, it's been that oftentimes it's very cathartic for the family. And I wish in so many ways that they would be able to engage in that conversation prior to someone's dying. Mm-hmm. Because when someone dies, there's a lot of moving parts. There's a lot of things you have to consider. People are often reacting to all of those circumstances. So it's not the best opportunity to really be thoughtful and intentional.
Right.
So to be able to have that conversation, especially before someone dies, because then they can be part of it, is very beneficial.
Yeah. Let's talk about, I don't know, remember if we talked about this on the air or off the air, but writing your own obituary. You're going to be talking about that in an upcoming
upcoming death cafe.
You know, I mean, you think, write my own obituary, but in a lot of ways that makes sense, doesn't it? Who knows you better than you?
Exactly, and I think it's a way to sort of inventory our lives and to consider what has been important to us, a lot of times the way people view us is very different from the way that we view ourselves. And by writing that, it gives us a chance to sort of reflect on our lives. And this is what I want to leave behind. This is what I want people to remember, how I want people to remember me.
I think so often someone's obituary ends up being a resume of sorts.
Right.
And there's a big difference between an obituary and a eulogy.
Mm-hmm.
I have the opportunity often to do committal services for folks over at the National Cemetery, and oftentimes I don't know these families. So in preparation, I'll ask them if they could give me some information about the person who I'll be memorializing. And they'll often say, well, you can read their obituary. That's just not enough.
Not enough, yeah. Right. Mary Lou is giving us a call from Chatham. Hi, Mary Lou.
Yes, good morning, and thank you so much for having this program. I was instrumental in attending a church here on the Cape many, many, many years ago regarding a talk around the coffee table.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually were sitting around a coffee table with family members, and all they were encouraging people to do is just to engage in conversation. And the small group that was presenting this, they ended up just serving coffee and cake or coffee and cookies. And what this all inspired some people to start talking, and if they had difficulty talking, they would call in the group and they kind of go in and say, well, let's see what's going on here. What do you want to talk about? You know, they would engage it.
Yeah, Mary Lou, that's exactly, I think, what's happening here. And we should mention the Death Cafe, Falmouth Death Cafe, meets 6:30 to 8:30 Wednesday at the First Congregational Church on Main Street in Falmouth. Future meetings generally the second week of the month. There's also a separate Death Cafe group meeting from 9 to 11 a.m. April 1st at the Barnstable Senior Center in Hyannis, coordinated by Beacon Hospice. And we'll have more information about the Falmouth and Hyannis Death Cafes at our website, capeandislands.org. Reverend Nell Fields of the Wacoit Congregational Church, Reverend Jonathan Drury of the First Congregational Church of Falmouth, and Heather Massey, home funeral educator and representative for the Funeral Consumers Alliance of Eastern Massachusetts. Thank you all so much for being with us today and telling us about this. And this week we dropped in at the Brewster Ladies Library, where every other Tuesday members of the hospice choir seasons rehearse, and we're going to hear that coming up right after the break. You're listening to The Point. This week, we dropped in at the Brewster Ladies Library, where every other Tuesday members of the hospice choir seasons rehearse. Jane Lowy is the musical director of Seasons. And Jane, tell us a little bit about how you choose the music that you sing.
Okay, there are three main rivers, let's say, or streams of thought around hospice choirs. And there is the Hallowell School, there's the Threshold School, and then there's the Hybrid School, which is kind of what we are. And so I pick up music from those other different streams, things that make sense to me. So we've got the ones in different languages. Then what we try to do is have a little bit of each religious tradition. So we have a few Jewish-centered songs. We have, you know, Christian songs. We have, like, a Buddhist blessing, so that if people are very attentive to their religion, that we want to be able to be prepared for that. And then we have a couple of patriotic songs if we are working with veterans at their death, so we want to be prepared to something with something for meaning for them. And it seems like we have to read the energy of the room, and as we go and have experience, we realize that, like, some people when they first get on hospice need more kind of engaging and upbeat songs, and towards when they're in what we call vigil sings, or when they're ready to pass, it's very close, then they need more quiet and blessing type songs. So we're filling in as we go out and find, like, an energy that we can't meet yet, so we source out songs. So we have kind of a variety.
Now, you mentioned that some of the music is in different languages. You don't obviously have to speak those languages, do you? Or, I mean, how do you teach the group the languages?
Oh, well, that's like almost learning any song. You basically listen to the sounds and repeat them. So we learn all of our songs by ear first, and then we pass out sheet music so that people can go back and fuss over them after that.
Yeah. So you've been together for, what, about a year now?
Yes.
And it looks like you got quite a big group here. How many members are there?
15.
15. Mm-hmm. But you know, all 15 go to someone's home. I mean, you know, you practice on, what, twice a month here, Tuesday evenings. That's your rehearsal time.
Right.
But would you go in smaller groups?
Smaller groups. Sometimes we are invited to go into a nursing home situation where a person is dying and under hospice care but living in an institution. So we go there, and more bodies can actually fit in often. So we might have 7 to 9 people that go out. But most rooms and places where people are in beds, they have a smaller space, so we'll go maybe 6 people is kind of optimum. them. We'll have two from each singing part. Often we sing in either two or three parts.
And you told me before we started recording that you don't have a lot of people really requesting your services yet. You've been around for about a year, but you're finding it tough to find enough. So do you go outside of Brewster, or is it just in Brewster?
We go from Yarmouth to P-Town.
Oh, okay.
So you would think there would be a few people that might apply to, considering our aging population and how many clients are actually going through hospices.
So why do you think there hasn't been more of a need or a call for it?
Well, I think we don't really like to think we're dying, basically. And we don't want to admit it. And not only that, I think when we get in, if we say we're dying, we say we're on hospice, and we invite in singers or other kinds of services, we might have to really sit and sink into the feelings of, that are going on surrounding that as well. And I think sometimes we like to just keep busy and involved and engaged, and so we can hurry up through this or whatever that we do as humans to kind of not feel that.
Nancy Higgins is a social worker and the intake coordinator for Season. So tell us how this idea for a choir got started.
Well, actually, Jane Lowy and I were having coffee at the Sparrow, and this is something that Jane had been thinking about for quite a while, is starting some type of hospice choir on Cape Cod. And she had done some background and had connections with the Hollowell Choir from Vermont, and we just started talking about it. And Jane, with her background in Common Voices and her all her experience directing choruses, and then for myself being a bereavement coordinator currently with a hospice, I thought that this would really be something valuable that we could bring to our patients and their families.
So what's been the reaction? I'm assuming families call you?
So the families will contact me, and we have a designated phone line, 508-237-8033. That's the number that the families call. And I'll just do a little bit of an intake in which I discuss, you know, what condition is the person in right now? Is this going to be someone who's actively dying that we're singing to, or someone who's awake and alert? Because that'll help Jane with the selection of music. And I'll get a little bit of cultural background, and were they a veteran? What kind of music might they like? Those kind of questions.
What's been the response from the patients who've had your services, who've had you singing at their bedside? What have they said to you about that experience?
The response has been very, very positive. And actually, we had one gentleman who had dementia and couldn't really talk at all. And during one song that we were singing, he started singing the words. So that was quite a response. And then from someone, a patient who was alert, and his family, you could see that they were really being brought into a special moment together of the feelings of listening to the singing and the music. And this gentleman happened to have other family members there and grandchildren, and you could see that it was very meaningful for all of them.
That must be a powerful moment for the singers as well.
Very powerful. Very powerful. It really, it brings you into someone's experience, and you are just feel so honored and privileged to be part of it.
I noticed that we have all women here tonight, but that's not intentional,
that was
right?
Not by design. No, no, we're very open to men. But the women are the ones who responded, so.
Yeah. I imagine if you get a few men on board, your repertoire would increase. Some
yes,
of you.
definitely, yes. Yes, Jane would welcome that.
Jane, tell me about this chair that you have set up here. This is where your practice? How does this work?
Well, I got this idea from the Threshold Choirs, which started out in the West Coast, and this chair is a way for us to begin to drop into the idea we're singing for somebody. We're not just singing songs like in a regular choir. And what we've noticed when we practice this way is that we sing differently when we're singing to somebody and we know that, you know, it really matters to them. And also it changed how we sing in the circle to have been on the receiving end of this. So when you're in the chair and you realize that certain things, like one of the things I realized is that it doesn't matter if we're perfect, it just matters if we're really heartfelt and we're doing our best and we're really communicating the love that we feel.
So you take turns sitting in this chair then?
Yes. But tonight, of course, we wanted you to sit in the chair.
All yes. Right. I'm ready.
Okay. We'd like to sing to you a song that's from the Jewish tradition called Lechi Lach. And I just would like you to experience the whole group singing to you with a sense of love and kindness. Okay.
Roseanne Shapiro, yes. Tell us why you joined and what this means to you.
Well, singing has been a part of my life since I was little. I've also had experience working as a hospice social worker, so I've been with people who are close to death. And the idea of bringing my voice and my singing to that situation really appealed to me. Plus, I've known Jane for many years, and I really trust the direction that she was going to take this program.
Marvelous. I thought you said you weren't perfect. You sound pretty perfect to me. You sing like angels. It's beautiful. It's beautiful.
Can we sing you a song in a different language?
Absolutely. I'd love that.
This one's called Tuma Mina, and it's from South Africa, and we're singing in two different South African languages, Zulu and Soto.
Who's singing Zulu and who's singing Soto?
We're all singing both.
Kathy Wimberly. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I've always loved to sing, and it's always been a gift to me, and I thought this was one way that I could help bring comfort and encouragement, bring a little peace. I've been at deathbeds before and at birthing beds, and I know that birth and death are all a part of this life, and going to sing for people is one more way of bringing the whole circle of life into our daily lives and giving a little joy to others.
Another beautiful song. You're good at this. Gorgeous.
Well, okay, you have to have one more.
Okay, no, I'm not complaining.
Okay, this is one of my favorites because, well, you'll hear it in the words, and I just want you to have one of my favorites, okay? And it's called The Thing That Makes You Beautiful.
There's not a pretty or a handsome that could ever stand.
Mim Selleck, hi. Kind of like Roseanne, I just felt that singing is my way of communicating, but in a two-way street, and I just felt that doing something like that would just be a way to give and receive.
Do you have auditions? I mean, everybody sings so well. Who can join this?
Well, it was open to anybody that felt like they could carry a tune, that they could communicate kindness with their voice, and that they could be in relationship with other singers and commit to what was implied emotionally and just showing up. But one of the things that we noticed is different kinds of singers showed up, people that learned by ear and people that learned by reading music, and somehow we all managed to come into relationship and find a way to learn the music. It was
beautiful job. Thank you for inviting me. Really appreciated it.
Thank you.
Get ready for that phone to ring.
Okay. Amy Vins produces The Point with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.